Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Well, where are we at here on Tuesday? We have new polls out showing that Donald Trump's rally around the flag boost has faded a little bit. The Fed has announced a $2.3 trillion stimulus plan. Apparently, they looked at Congress and figured, hey, if you guys aren't going to come up with a deal, we're just going to do it for you. We're just going to pump this money. And of course, then the Senate promptly adjourned without passing either the Democrat or Republican small business plan. So there is that. Hey, just a couple of quick notes. You can subscribe to us, the Bulwark Podcast. You can subscribe to us anywhere where they have podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Castro, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, Stitcher. We really appreciate that. And once again, very grateful for all of you who have been listening to us. And if you have not yet done so, you can get the Bulwark injected directly into your email box if you subscribe to our newsletters. We have three every day. We have a podcast every day, but we have three newsletters every day. I have one in the morning, Morning Shots. JVL has the Triad Midday, and Jim Swift has Overtime. So you might want to check that out to be up to date on everything that we are doing. Also, just a quick note, I have a piece over at Politico magazine this morning about the court wars in Wisconsin. And this is it's relevant because in order to understand the incredible FUBAR wrapped in a snafu of Wisconsin, you have to understand that the decision to go ahead with that election on Tuesday had nothing to do with the presidential primary. That was almost an afterthought in Wisconsin. What really drove that is the intense politics that surrounds the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. And I think it's impossible to overstate how that's really become kind of the center of the political partisan divisions in Wisconsin, with all sorts of implications, including the fact that it is the court itself and then becomes the arbiter of these challenges to the election. So joining us today on the podcast is, and this is a return visit, Alexander Nazarian, who is a national correspondent for Yahoo News based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Alexander.
Thank you for having me, Charlie. I enjoyed talking with you before, and I'm sure we'll have a great conversation this time.
Well, you did compare this to going to the dentist, though, right before we started, right?
That was
you were comparing record. Talking to me is like the same as going to the dentist, or am I taking that out of context?
That's fake news.
It is
fake news.
Yeah, no, it is somewhat out of context. Okay,
you'll never make it.
Yeah. Okay, do you watch the White House briefings? Because I have a confession to make. I can't take it anymore. I mean, I Twitter watch them, but I find myself even, less and less watching them. It's just too, there's so many things in the world that make you dumber. And I put that in the category. I actually put that really sort of high up on the list that if I spent an hour listening to that, I'm really sure that I would kill brain cells. Do you have to watch them? Do you do it?
I do. Because, look, we know that Trump is going to go after Cry and Chuck Schumer, after John Carl of ABC News. But we also know that Dr. Birx, Dr. Fauci, and others, maybe Surgeon General Adams, will go up there and say legitimately interesting stuff. I haven't had enough coffee. Legitimately interesting stuff is not the greatest phrase in the world, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
Trump will announce, for example, we are going to look more carefully at African-American infection rates. So at the very least, I can then follow up with the White House press shop and say, well, if the president said at the briefing, can you explain what he meant? So I do watch them. I understand the concerns people have. I will take 2 hours of the nation's top officials discussing this crisis. I think the Wall Street Journal editorial this morning calling those meetings a wasted opportunity is going to, I'm guessing it has already circulated in the West Wing. I don't know how much difference it's going to make. If Wall Street Journal editorials made a difference, things would be quite different, for better or worse. I don't think Trump listens to them, but I do think that there is a concern that those briefings, especially in the last few days, have become the kind of back and forth we saw in earlier months of Trump on the South Lawn of the White House, maybe just talking off the cuff, denouncing political foes in the media, and not leaving us with much of substance, because these things should be substantive. And he looked to him. Yeah, look, he can once a week at least stay on message and not engage in this stuff. And he was better at it, I think, last week. This week, there's just been a lot of political and media stuff and the inspectors general. None of that is helpful to his cause, never mind the cause of.
Well, I think the thing he may look at is noticing that this is not helping him in the polls, because we know he does pay attention to that. But you mentioned this Wall Street Journal editorial, and they've been very Trump friendly, although they've been willing to call him out. They write, sometime in the last 3 weeks, Trump seems to have concluded the briefing should be a showcase for him. Perhaps they substitute in his mind for the campaign rallies that he can no longer hold because of the risk. Bingo. Perhaps he resented the media adulation that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has been receiving. Whatever the reason, the briefings are now all about the president. And then they write this. The president's outbursts against his political critics are notably off key at this moment. This isn't impeachment, and COVID-19 isn't Shifty Schiff. It's a once a century threat to American life and livelihood. Yeah, so that's a pretty strong hit. Now, in terms of the briefings, I do not want to get involved in, you know, bashing the reporters. This seems to be, you know, one of the Donald Trump, one of the things that Donald Trump is doing is he loves to have these fights with the press, right? I mean, this is not a one-off. This is not a blunder or a gaffe. He knows that if he can turn these into him versus the press, that he, you know, he wins. He thinks it's a win. And, so even you take a legitimate question, Jonathan Carl's question the other day, a series of even a Fox reporter's question, and he lashes out at the reporter, and his base absolutely freaking loves it. But then there are moments where you go, you know, what is the stupidest question? Now, up until yesterday, I really thought the dumbest questions were probably from, you know, OAN, you know, One America Now. No, they still are. They're in a class by themselves. But did you catch that this question from the New York Post guy? Let me play this. And I want to just put this in context, that you're in the middle of this national pandemic. 10 million Americans had lost their jobs. And by the way, that's before the numbers this morning, 6.6 million more Americans file for unemployment comp. You know, I'm older than you, Alexander, but I never remember a point where we had a headline saying 17 million Americans have lost their job in the last 3 weeks. I mean, holy crap.
Astonishing.
It is astonishing. You have, you know, 14,000 Americans are dead. You are a reporter, and you have a chance to ask the president of the United States at this moment any question you want. And this is what the New York Post reporter asked.
So one of the biggest rating hits of the coronavirus, aside from these briefings, has been a show on Netflix called Tiger King.
Yeah.
And the man who's the star of this is a former zoo owner who's serving a 22-year prison sentence. He's asking you for a pardon, saying he was unfairly convicted. Your son yesterday jokingly said that he was going to advocate for it. And I was wondering if you've seen the show and if you have any thoughts on pardoning Joe Exotic.
Which son? It must be Don. It was. I had a feeling it was Don.
Oh, Alexander, I just want to slam my head into the desk.
Let me say a couple things. First of all, look, I haven't seen the show. It looks kind of dumb to me. I know I'll probably get trolled for that. But it doesn't, I'm not interested in it. So is that okay? Can I say that?
I'm not going to watch the show. No, you can say that.
Look, would I use my opportunity to ask the president of the United States that question? No, I don't think it's a great use of time. I think I'm guessing it was an attempt to leaven the atmosphere a little bit, just to sort of be generous to that reporter whom I don't know. And I guess the other issue I do want to point out is, look, you do take a risk as a reporter going into that room. The Brady briefing room, under the best of circumstances, is hot, cramped, stuffy, not especially pleasant. In the midst of a pandemic, it's pretty much the last place I'd want to be. So those reporters who are going in there, honestly, they're taking a risk. And it's not a risk that I've taken, although I could go into those briefings, and I'm not, because I'm I'm nervous to do so. And so it's anyone
not landing on Omaha Beach.
No,
I mean, come on.
Sure. No, of course. No, it's not. You're right. It is not.
Calibrate the risk.
Sure. Fair enough. I just wanted to sort of, I guess I'm trying to be generous, just to sort of, as a counter argument, but no, of course, do I think we need to be devoting even a millisecond of pandemic response to this guy with a mullet and a tiger or whatever? I still don't understand what the issue is.
Okay. So I follow your stuff, Alexander, and I'm sure that I'm about to say something that no one's ever said to you ever in your whole life.
Uh-oh.
I'm just kidding. You are too nice.
I'm too nice?
You're just too nice. That was one of the stupidest, most unprofessional moments in American journalism. How moronic do you have to be to ask that question at that moment? The guy should just, you know, he should walk out of there and he should say, okay, you know, here was my big moment. I'm turning in my press pass. I'm going to go get a job at Walmart. I'm just done. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't want to spend too much time on all of that. It's just,
some of those questions are really good, right? Sometimes you get a really tough, good question.
And that makes me
confident that those reporters there, for the most part, are not transcriptionists. They're real journalists looking to press Trump and everyone else on the issues. But yeah, once in a while, you get someone who wants to go viral for something insignificant. And that's just the media ecosystem we live in, right? That it could actually be more beneficial to you in a certain sense to ask a silly question and get a silly response than to ask a serious question. Right? I can do on a daily podcast.
I can ask silly questions of folks because we have all the time in the world and everything, and nobody really cares. But when you have that one moment, it's like, you know, this one moment in your entire life, you know, where you're able to talk directly to the president of the United States. And so, what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about Bernie? Let's talk about the briefings just a little bit more, because I know that you're a Pence watcher, and it really is fascinating that, you know, Pence has taken a backseat to the president, but I do see this narrative on social media, and maybe it's because we've just moved the goalposts, but that, you know, that after the rambling and the personal insults and the narcissism of the president, that Pence has been much more substantive. So talk to me, because you've been a student of Mike Pence. Has this been a good moment for Mike Pence? Is he handling it reasonably well?
I think he's given who he is, his experience, and also the incredible skepticism he faced from the press before this. I think he has done a terrific job, sort of within the context of the Trump administration's response, right? I don't know if this is a 2024 audition, but I think a crisis is always an audition of sorts. And look at the way Pence has handled this relative to the way Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has handled this crisis. And DeSantis, I think prematurely, has been talked about as a 2024 candidate. Now, it's preposterous that we're talking about a presidential election past this one, but we are. And I think DeSantis has done himself no favors with his equivocating response. Whereas, Pence, for example, when Trump was attacking Washington State Governor Jay Inslee or Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Pence was careful to sort of really, I would say, shower them with praise, to not engage in vituperation, to sort of play the sober counterpart to Trump. And, you know, that meant sometimes deviating from what Trump said, which some of us didn't think Pence would ever do, right? That he would always sort of repeat what Trump said, but he hasn't. In some ways, he has guided the tone of the response much more than Trump. And look, a lot of the communications work is being done by Katie Miller, who comes from his office. Alyssa Farah is now moving over to the chief of staff suite, and she comes from his office. I don't know exactly how close he is with the new chief of staff, Mark Meadows, but I do think they have a pretty good relationship from their days in the House of Representatives. So I think that's going to benefit Pence as well. He's in a really good place right now within Trump world.
Interesting. This is really an interesting analysis because, you know, he'd been in eclipse for so long, and it would really sort of establish that image of him being just the ultimate Trump toady, you know, the guy that, you know, if Trump right. takes his water bottle down, he takes his water bottle down. But mm-hmm. but there is that, I'm glad you used that term, that it's sort of an audition, because you look at him, and if you leave all the other stuff out, and I'm just kind of just, you know, in the moment here, just leave everything else out, you can imagine him being the president. And the contrast that he's creating is interesting, that he's doing it without insulting or diminishing Trump, although it's always dangerous to overshadow the president in this world. But he has handled it, and he does sort of remind people that, you know, he used to be a governor. He's actually done things before. So you're right. This is a good moment for him. Any speculation that he was going to be dumped from the ticket, I think, becomes more absurd with every passing day, unless, of course, Trump feels the need to create a scapegoat. But I don't see that, because Trump is obviously, his whole narrative is going to be, I won. You know, we brought the economy back. Everything is wonderful. He can't basically say I won, but the guy I put in charge of it screwed up. So, yeah, this is an interesting moment for Mike Pence.
Look, if you just watch those briefings and you didn't know anything about American politics, and I asked you, who was the president of the United States? And you'd say, oh, that silver-haired guy who just looks very solid, who speaks about bipartisanship yeah. and Americans coming together, who doesn't engage in any attacks, who looks serious, who sounds serious, who has spoken with something that seems to me to be conviction. And I've wondered what Pence would need to do to come into his own without mm-hmm. eclipsing Trump. Because the worst thing you can do is eclipse Trump. Just ask your dear friend Steve Bannon. Right?
My close friend, yeah.
So you can't go out there and do Time magazine covers and sort of become a celebrity in your own right. And look, Pence is a pretty masterful politician. We don't give him credit for that. We treat him as this guy from Indiana who just sort of ended up in the vice president's, in the Naval Observatory in the vice president's residence. That's ridiculous. He knows what he's doing. He's sharp. He's navigating this, I would say, as well as anyone else, in terms of not irritating Trump, but also not alienating the American public, which is so important right now. Because look, people are watching those briefings. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but people are watching. They're seeing Trump. They're seeing Fauci. They're seeing Pence. And they're reaching conclusions about how they have to behave, right? So if Pence says, we've got to keep doing social distancing, I think there's probably going to be people who conclude, we've got to keep doing this. Just like if Trump says, I'm not wearing a mask, I'm guessing some people will conclude, well, I don't need to wear a mask either.
You know, this is interesting because I've actually been somewhat disillusioned, obviously a lot disillusioned with Mike Pence over the last few years, but it does take a skilled politician to thread the needle that you're describing. You know, how do you create that contrast with Trump without alienating him in any way whatsoever? And he does appear, I'm not reading any backbiting, you know, backstabbing stuff, not that much. And you know, part of what he's doing is he's presenting a much calmer, more mature persona. It is sort of, you know, if he can manage to be Trumpism without the crazy, Trumpism without the bluster, he will have come up with a formula for at least within the Republican Party to do all of that. So he's clearly, I have not, have you seen any, now that we're talking about this, have you seen any approval rating numbers on Pence? I mean, I'm seeing them on Trump and Cuomo and Dr. Fauci. I don't think I've seen one on Pence. That's which, you know, is odd now that we're talking about it.
I haven't, Charlie. I'm guessing at some point we will see some polling on him. I mean, look, he is now 60 years old, right? He's well he's more than a decade younger than the two presumptive nominees, Trump and Biden. He has to be thinking about 24.
Oh, I would absolutely,
be
sure.
Work, right? I'm sure that he is watching DeSantis flail. I'm sure he's keeping an eye on Nikki Haley. I can't predict exactly that field right now, but those are two people who are going to be there. And I think he's actually, frankly, earned some goodwill with the media, because there was the way that people treated the announcement that he would be sort of taking over from Azar as the head of this task force is, here's a right wing heartland conservative. Christian,
who's going to pray us out of it, right?
Pray us out of it. And that just hasn't been the case, right? There was some reference by reporters, myself included, to the HIV/AIDS epidemic that took place in Indiana when he was governor. And that, of course, is concerning, but I don't see him. He has been as effusive about Dr. Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx, the response coordinator on the task force, as he has been about President Trump. And that's really something. Remember, this is a guy who has been branded, whether justly or not, as anti-science. And I, you know, frankly, as somebody who watches this every day, who follows this every day, I just haven't seen that.
Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit. On yesterday's podcast, I was talking with Tim Miller. During our conversation, the news broke that Bernie Sanders has dropped out and the Democratic race is over, which is, you know, still extraordinary. Right. That April 8th, you know, that
I forgot there's a presidential race. I totally forgot.
It does feel like that, doesn't it? It did feel like, oh yeah, that's right, it's going on. And apparently Bernie made up his mind that to pull the plug. So give me your sense of what the mood is, what's going on among Democrats right now, because of course, immediately we had a lot of unhappiness from the Bernie folks. There are a lot of dead enders. There's actually a hashtag Never Biden out there. There seems to be some anger on the part of some Democrats that Bernie has not gone further. So where are we at now? How are Democrats feeling in this strange moment where that whole thing is done? It's over. Biden's going to be the nominee.
Well, I will just give you my observations of talking with people on the left side of the spectrum, which is, to be perfectly honest with you, there's just not a lot of Biden enthusiasm. I don't think there was a ton of Bernie enthusiasm from the center left, of course, which is not news to you, but there's not enthusiasm for Biden either. I think there's a lot of fear that his absence during the coronavirus response I can't imagine that it has helped. This kind of hunkering down in Delaware and sort of issuing occasional, you know, what is he doing? He's done some virtual meetings. He had a conversation with Trump.
What should he be doing? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know. We can't hold events, right? There's not much, right? So those briefings, Charlie, are perfect for Trump. They're terrible for Biden. Every day Trump gets to go out there and be the wartime president he wants to be, whereas Biden can do things from his, you know, can do a video from his basement or his library. And as soon as the video airs, the Trump rapid response,
boom, boom, boom.
They find something he did. He, you know, whatever mistake he made in the video, he looked down at his notes. He mistook Chicago for Cleveland, whatever it is, and they blast that out. So, you know, they don't treat him. They treat him as a sort of bumbling elderly gentleman prone to making mistakes and not really to lead the country.
Okay, I take your point here, but let me give you the counter narrative on all of this. You know, first of all, we were looking at some of the latest polls. We have the latest Quinnipiac poll released on Wednesday. You have the Monmouth University poll released this morning. Biden leads Trump by 8 points and 4 points, respectively, and both of those are outside the poll's margin of error, despite what we've been going through. And then there are those who argue, look, nothing that Joe Biden says right now is going to make any difference in November. Nothing he says or does is, you know, right now it's all about, you know, it's going to be a referendum on Donald Trump. So to a certain extent, yes, he's in eclipse. That's inevitable. There's nothing he can do about it. And he just needs to sort of wait this out. And that apparently seems to be something that they've decided, that if Donald Trump's in the process of, you know, blowing himself up, you know, failing at this crisis, then, you know, let's let him. Let's not interrupt him. Let's not provide any counter narratives.
Right. So in your version of events, this is like the montage in every Rocky movie where Rocky is preparing for the big fight. He's running up the slopes of some mountain in Siberia, or he's running through South Philly, and he's getting ready. He's hunkering down. Okay, maybe. Look, let's say we have a big 9/11 type commission and it finds that Trump did all these things incorrectly. Okay, I guess Biden can sort of own that and say it would never happen under me. But what if this thing is calmed down by?
Well, that's right.
Let's say August. Let's say August, this thing more or less goes away. The Democrats aren't going. What do they do with? By then, they will have had enough evidence of short. Well, inevitably, there will have been shortcomings. There already are shortcomings in the way Trump has responded, and shortcomings may be a kind word, frankly. But what are they going to do with those? Hold impeachment in September 2020? Like, how are they going to weaponize Trump's failure?
That is a good point. And there are some people who say, look, you know, ultimately this is going to be determined by the reality. If people are out of work, if their aunt or their cousin or their grandmother has died, it doesn't matter what either political party says. This is going to be determined by, you know, how people feel about the country. But by the way, I kind of like the Joe Biden sitting in his basement in Delaware doing the Rocky thing. I think that is kind of cool.
Charlie, I also believe that if he picks a progressive woman as vice president, especially a woman of color, he will reignite some of the excitement of the.
All right, let's talk about that, because I think that is going to be the big political story, since there's nothing else is, you know, major going to be happening. And given his age, that decision is, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, you know, normally the choice of a vice president is way overhyped. We pretend like it's really, really important, when in fact it very seldom really makes any difference. This one feels like it will make a difference. So what is your sense of that, and which of the candidates are going to reignite any sort of excitement?
I think Warren could be an exciting pick for the progressive base. I think she would do it. I think, while I don't think temperamentally she's suited to be a vice president, I think she's too smart and too sort of energetic for that role. I think the implicit understanding that she would be there sort of, you know, as a president in training would maybe make smooth the way for her. Kamala, I see as a potential as well, although you could also have her as a Supreme Court pick, though I wouldn't broadcast that just yet if I were Biden, knowing because that would obviously give, you know, people like Judicial Watch just a ton of time to amass an arsenal of sort of opposition research against her or any other judicial pick. You know, look, if you go with someone like Klobuchar, just not to pick on her, but that totally deflates any enthusiasm from the base, right?
Okay, let me just stop right there. This base, what do they need to be enthusiastic more than Donald Trump on the ballot and the prospect of another 4 years of Donald Trump?
What do they need? I'll tell you, they need Medicare for all. They need I'm just telling you what they've said. You know this. Yeah. Medicare for all. I get tuition free public education. A Green New Deal. So unless
if they don't get all the free stuff, then they're gonna go. We're okay with Trump. We're not gonna do anything.
Well, they would. Yes. I mean, that's they want. They want corporate, you know, higher taxes, Green New Deal. And for them, not having – and this is what I think people in the media don't understand about the way the sort of the progressive left sees this. For them, a centrist is as good as a conservative.
As bad as a conservative.
Yeah, as bad or as good as. It is. There is no difference between a centrist Democrat and a conservative Republican.
Okay, really. Outside of Twitter world, is there a large portion of the electorate that honestly does not think that that Donald Trump poses a greater threat than a centrist Democrat? I mean, are they in that much of an ideological bubble?
Oh, sure. Your suburban Democrat in Milwaukee, of course, yeah. Of course, he or she believes that and will vote for Biden. But there is a progressive, the AOC left, clearly is going to be reluctant to vote for the guy who helped pass the toughest crime bill in recent, you know, in modern American history.
Yeah, but these are the people that lost. I mean, this was a Democratic primary. It's over now, and essentially, Democrats decided that they wanted the centrist, they wanted the pragmatic approach, that they didn't feel the need for the red meat, shift to the left.
I also think the progressive left sees itself as playing a much longer game. They don't. Okay. I believe this is my observation. They are willing to even lose a presidential election in order if it means they don't forsake their principles and sell out to the the Klobuchar Harris
corporate Democrat. Well, but how big a portion of the electorate is that? I mean, it's I take your point, but Donald Trump is a unique political phenomenon, and so are they willing, really willing to? I mean, that's not enough motivation for them. No,
I think to them, a Democrat, and I'm just using him as a reference point, a Democrat like Mayor Pete, who is going to be timid on sort of corporate taxes, timid on healthcare, is there really that much difference? They want radical change.
Yeah.
Listen, for them, I'm just telling you how, is not for nothing that I spend a couple of years living in Berkeley, California.
No. This is good explaining because it's part of the mentality. I mean, I do spend a lot of time either on the right or in the center right. This sort of like, if we don't get the Green New Deal, which we're never going to get, or we don't get Medicare for All, which we're never going to get, then we're not going to play. We're going to go. We're not going to support the very progressive Democratic nominee against Donald freaking Trump. I mean, I do know that they're there.
Charlie, and I mean this, you're a much more astute political observer than I am, but this is what I think you misunderstand here.
No.
They believe that they will let you burn down the house.
Yeah.
Because they believe they can rebuild that house with the Green New Deal. They believe they will get the Green New Deal, but only after voters make mistakes like, in their mind, reelecting Trump or even electing centrists. They believe their time will – they're revolutionaries. You know, like any revolution, they're willing to hide in the mountains until it's time, right, to storm the palace. And it doesn't look like this is the year. Does that mean they will stay home for Biden? No, I think most of them will vote. But also we talk about – you were referencing the margin. Well, what was the margin in Wisconsin, in Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania? We're talking
slivers.
We're talking about just a few thousand people in those states, in Florida.
Well, I think in Wisconsin, Jill Stein got more votes here. I don't have the numbers up in front of me, but I'm just thinking from memory that Jill Stein got more votes than the margin of victory. In other words, if the Jill Stein people had voted for Hillary Clinton, she would have won Wisconsin. So you are right. I just wonder, and I know that there is that impulse of let's go to the mountains, and let them kill each other, and then we will come down and create the perfect world. But also you could end up going up in the mountains and being like the, you know, Japanese soldiers at the end of World War II, where you're living in the caves up in the mountain and nobody's told you the war is over and you just sort of stay there.
That's an excellent extension of the metaphor. Listen, I hope I might get in trouble with my in-laws, but because they'll listen to this. They are California radicals, and they represent. They have Bernie stickers. They're huge Bernie fans. Everyone they know is a huge Bernie fan. If you over a glass of good California Pinot, ask them, what do you think of Obama? They would say he was a conservative, not conservative, okay. just a conservative. And he failed progressivism completely. I believe that most people who support Bernie, that's not true. I believe a significant share of Bernie supporters feel exactly the way that my in-laws do, that the Obama wing of the party is just Reagan Republicanism.
Obama wing of the party.
Yeah. And look, that's why, the Obama-Clinton wing of the party that has never liked Bernie, that has never trusted Bernie, that has never believed that he could get any of this done. Well, there's just not a lot of mutual love between those two wings. So I don't.
No, interesting. This is an interesting perspective. It is. And let me just as I'm thinking this through, and I probably shouldn't say this either, but there's a kernel of truth in sort of the rejectionist position, which is that if Democrats do nominate Joe Biden and Joe Biden in this environment goes down to defeat, this will be the signal for the Democratic Party to say, okay, we've tried centrism now twice, we failed. Let's go for the red meat. Let's go for the Democratic Socialist with the much more progressive agenda. In terms of centrism, the defeat of Joe Biden really becomes catastrophic, I think.
And right now, I'm worried that there's so little energy on the left. Look, people right now are concerned for their jobs, their lives, their parents. They're just not the ground game. I'm sorry to use that term, yeah. But the organization that should be happening right now for sort of a nationwide Biden movement, because this has to be a movement, it's just not happening. And yes, it might start to happen in August when hopefully the coronavirus pandemic has subsided. But even then, that seems too late. He should be using this time to start building that general election organization. He's not able to do it. Not because he can't do it, because public health explicitly prevents him from doing most of the things he should be. So that's just incredibly difficult.
That's plausible, but I remember a little bit later in 2016, the discussion about the fact that Donald Trump didn't really have a campaign. He didn't have a campaign organization. He had no internal ground game whatsoever. He had to rely on Reince Priebus and the RNC. But one of the things that we have seen over the last few years, and then maybe this is like a category shift for those of us that talk about politics, Joe Biden has been winning these primaries without spending any money. He won these primaries without having a ground game. Donald Trump had no Trump ground game. And so if money determined everything, Michael Bloomberg would be the next president of the United States. If the ground game determined everything, I'm guessing that multiple other candidates, including Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, maybe Pete Buttigieg, had infinitely better ground games than Joe Biden. So maybe we're in a different era. Maybe the way we communicate, the way, in fact, political winds move has changed, because Joe Biden is right now in this dominant position in the Democratic Party without any of the things that we would have thought would have been necessary. Of course, he's got a lot of other assets as well. But you're mentioning that there's not a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, people are keeping their heads down right now, I think, because we are going through this genuinely frightening, unpredictable time. But I'm guessing that at some point there's going to be a head of steam that I'm guessing is going to be angry and focused. I don't know how that plays out politically.
I completely agree with you. And what I also wonder if at some point people do. I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe people just say in November, we're done. We're exhausted by Trump. Okay, you know, he handled the pandemic. He didn't handle it well. But that notwithstanding, we are just tired of him and we want him out.
I think, see, that's my gut instinct here, and I know that I repeat myself, but you know, I keep thinking of, you know, how elections sometimes come down to simple themes. You know, the whole Reagan theme: are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Now it's going to be in 2020: can you take four more years of this? And so you have the anger and the outrage and everything, but you also have just the exhaustion. Please, Lord, make it stop. It's just, by the way, while we are speaking, a new CNN poll was just released showing among registered voters, Biden with an 11-point lead over Trump, 53-42. Wow.
That should be very sobering to the Trump team. I am sure, you know, Brad Parscale and Jared are going to be anxious and going to lose sleep over that.
Well, they should. Well, of course, the national polls don't mean anything. It's also the swing state polls, which are going to be much closer. But this would certainly be an indication that at a moment when you would expect a president facing this crisis, you know, if you don't get a bump now, what's going to happen between now and I understand the fantasy that Trump has, that the economy, you know, that we're going to stop the coronavirus and the economy is just going to come roaring back and it's going to be morning in America. But that's hard to feel that way on a day in which we just saw 6.6 more million Americans filing for unemployment comp. I mean, wow.
This is what I think he has going for him, which is that once those checks start going out, mm-hmm. once the loans are being made in significant numbers, and once there are people returning to work, I think many people will understand that he himself, you know, it's not as if he is signing all those checks. It's Congress, it's the federal bureaucracy making sure that those things happen. But at the same time, it will redound to him to some degree. Right?
What if we still have double-digit unemployment?
If we have double-digit unemployment, I can't imagine any president. Any president being reelected, except I guess FDR. But listen, what if he does? And Charlie, just really kind of
no, I understand. Yeah.
What if he and Pelosi and McConnell somehow settle on a $3 trillion infrastructure deal that passes miraculously in September. And it's like a work public, it's a WPA, new deal, sort of that, it's a program of that scale. Well, I mean, do I think that's going to happen? Do I think they have can they play a game that complex? They haven't shown it, but maybe they can. If they do, that's really dangerous for Biden because money in people's wallets
sure.
will be a huge determinant of how they vote.
Well, but see, then the question is, would Nancy Pelosi, who's a pretty savvy operator, would she make that move knowing that it really might reelect Donald Trump? That's a big question. I mean, the fact they couldn't come up with a deal today, I think, is an indication that there are limits to the bipartisan kumbaya that we saw over the last couple of weeks. Not to mention flipping it around, that there will be some unease, not as much as I would have hoped or thought, about this massive deficit spending on the part of conservatives. But I'm not going to overestimate the number of actual fiscal conservatives who remain in the world. But there's no question about it. Let me tell you, because every once in a while I have these flashes where I think I understand what Donald Trump is thinking. And by the way, that's usually it's like, I don't give him credit for great strategic thinking, but he does have this reptilian cunning. And he does, if you see everything as a television show, everything as a movie, you know, and you know, the comeback, and he's Rocky. He's the guy that comes back, and wins at the end. I mean, that will be his image for him. Do you know what I think one of the most important moments is going to be? And he's already focused on it, and I understand how he feels about it, is the NFL season starting.
So
if you bring the NFL back and you have these big crowds and you do the, you know, America chant, you know, that sort of thing, and you have the symbol of it, you may still have the American economy decimated, but he will focus on that image of bringing America back. There is just, somebody was asking about this the other day. There's no way that he does not really push for the NFL to be back before the election.
I'm no epidemiologist, but is it a good idea, Charlie, to have 100,000 people packed
in? It's a terrible idea.
It's probably not the smartest thing to do, but politically, often the politically smartest thing is not sort of the best thing to do for people's interests. This just goes sort of beyond Trump. But let me say this. Pelosi, of course, wants to see Trump defeated. She also needs to keep the House, right? There is no Nancy Pelosi. There's no Speaker Pelosi without a Democratic majority. I don't see how you keep that majority if Kevin McCarthy and House GOP leaders can go out there in November and say, do you know why you're unemployed? It's because Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer wouldn't strike a deal. They hate Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not difficult messaging, right? They hate Trump and they hate you. So vote Republican. Yeah,
the do nothing Congress. That's how Harry Truman pulled out the 1948 election. He ran against the Republican Congress that he was the do nothing Congress, and I think that's also would be a major part of the Trump playbook. Look at all I'm doing. I'm on television every night. What is Congress doing? Congress can have 1,000 votes, but if they're not on television, nobody knows what they're doing.
And I also I actually think Charlie, the same calculus goes for McConnell. He can't allow Schumer. They have a very narrow, you know, how many? It's been so long since I even walked the halls of Congress. I can't remember how many seats ahead Republicans are, but they could lose that slim majority if Schumer and the Democrats get to say, "Do you know why you're unemployed? Do you why you've stopped receiving benefits? It's because Mitch McConnell cares more about appointing conservative judges than he cares about you." So both Pelosi and McConnell have a huge amount to lose by not doing Trump's bidding. And Trump knows that.
The other issue, and I think this is, again, completely unpredictable in a certain way, with all of this money sloshing around and the fact that the president is firing these inspector generals right and left, that's normally kind of an insider story. But the potential for corruption and, you know, rigging this system seems high. And I wonder, you know, to the extent that people begin to think that the money is going to corporations, to well-connected, you know, well-connected insiders, that it begins to erode Trump's brand as a populist. Now, Joe Biden may not be the ideal candidate to exploit all of this, but there's certainly also the possibility that the way this plays out is very, very swampy. And I discussed this earlier on the podcast. I think this is also a danger the Democrats need to think about, is that, you know, when they vote unanimously for all of this stuff, they do own some of the downside as well. But I mean, the potential for incompetence and, you know, grift and graft is huge when you have this much free money sloshing around the system.
And we know that from the stimulus following the financial housing collapse of 2007-2008. There will inevitably be abuses. There will inevitably be silly programs that get money, or maybe programs that seem silly in a tweet or in a quick soundbite. And politicians just have to be aware of that. They're going to be held to account for how they're spending trillions of dollars. I sort of think that's a good thing. But yes, TARP, the Toxic Asset Relief Program that basically bailed out the financial industry, made money for the American people, but you would never know that for all the invective hurled its way. It was, you know, the way people would talk about it was, you know, the government came in and, you know, emptied your bank account and gave it to Goldman Sachs, right? So, and I think it was a failure on President Obama and Tim Geithner's part in not articulating We have to do this, and we are not giving banks a pass. You know, maybe they could have listened to the Elizabeth Warrens of the world more, but that's not what they chose to do. And that program was maligned as a result by both left and right.
Well, I mean, that's the political moment where people are suffering. They've made tremendous sacrifices. And this, by the way, is now what, like 98% of the public right now is making some sort of a sacrifice. They're suffering financially. They may be out of work. Things may be desperate for them. If they think that there are other people who are benefiting, and if it looks like Trump is taking care of his friends, that could be really toxic. And I hope the Democrats are smart enough to realize both the danger of getting in bed with him, but also the fact that this is kind of a moment to get back some of that populist mantle. I mean, this is one of the frustrating things about Trump. You know, Trump is has run as a populist, and he has governed as a plutocrat. And, the whole draining the swamp thing, with the exception of, denuding the federal bureaucracy, he has not drained the special interest swamp. He's just restocked it with his own lizard people. And I think that we may see that. In any case, part of the moment we're in right now is that nobody knows what's going to happen or where we're going to go. And I think that adds to the anxiety, and it's going to keep us busy for the rest of the year.
I'm in my garage. I've been reduced to working from my garage. There's a pug sleeping next to me. I mean,
this is great.
Yeah,
I've actually been doing cable TV hits via Skype, where I'm actually wearing pajama bottoms.
Can I say one last thing about just this whole situation? I think people who go on cable news do not need to. And Charlie, please, if you can, be the first. Just wear a T-shirt. Wear what you would wear. You don't need to. We don't need to believe that you walk around your house in a suit and tie. I just want somebody to do the Chris Cuomo thing, but without having to have coronavirus, where you're just in, a hoodie.
I'm not going there. In fact, I did debate not shaving. I went for a while, and I was thinking, I'm going to go on. I'm going to just do this. Is it? I'm here locked down in place. But then I woke up at 2:30, in the morning, and it was scratchy and everything. You do have a beard? You don't have a beard.
I have a coronavirus mustache.
But it was just, I got up literally in the middle of the night and I shaved it off. All right.
There's also every single person on cable news is now, I'm sorry, and I know you're great on MSNBC. I really mean that. But everyone is always sitting in front of Ulysses. a Norse dictionary. The thesis of Winston Churchill.
Yes.
Nonlinear geometry, an introduction. It's like, come on, guys. Come on. If you read the last.
No, this is the gig. It's like, Andrea Mitchell's show. I'm sorry. I was just reading my Hegel here. Let me just put this back on my shelf so that I can talk with you and straighten the tie that I'm wearing in my kitchen, which is pretty much my gig. I do that. So I can't make fun of anybody.
No,
I can't do that.
So did you go out to vote yesterday?
I applied for an absentee ballot. They sent it got there on time, and I mailed it back. So they tell me that as long as it's postmarked by Tuesday, which mine should have been, that, and if they get it by the 13th, which they should, that it will be counted. So I think that there's a non-zero chance that I will not have been disenfranchised.
Good. But you should be. You are a franchisee who deserves the vote.
I wanted a vote. Yeah.
It was dispiriting to see. I mean, it was sort of both inspiring and dispiriting to see people waiting in those long lines. I'm glad people voted. I wish they didn't have to put themselves into danger, or at the very least discomfort, to do so. But, that was the decision that was made. And
it should not have to be a heroic act to go out and cast your vote in a democracy. You should not have to make that. I mean, yes, it is inspiring to see people willing to make that, take those risks, but it was ridiculous watching that, and particularly, I mean, they're all wearing their masks and There's a story in the local newspaper that that medical experts are saying that this is likely to be a health disaster because of all the people that in fact did not engage in social distancing. And that's just sort of the weird thing. You know, the state says you're supposed to stay at home. You're not supposed to do this. And then, you know, in order for you to participate in society, you have to show up and stand in line for these out for hours and hours, which was absolutely ridiculous. And by the way, I think there's a huge amount of anger in places like the city of Milwaukee over what sure looked like an attempt to screw them over. When you have a city with 300,000 registered voters, normally 180 polling places, and you had just five. You had just five in the entire city of Milwaukee. You know, when I first saw that, I thought that was a misprint. I said, there's no way there's only five in a city the size of Milwaukee. So that's how nuts this is. Hey, Alexander, I appreciate all the time you spent with us today. Oh, very, very much.
So much fun talking with you. Thank you. Stay safe.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Trelly Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.